Let's pray. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Babaji Krishna,
Lahari Mahasya,
Swami Sri Yukteswarji,
Our own beloved Guru Preceptor,
Paramahansa Yoganandaji,
Saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Divine joy. Bless us with thy intoxicating, ever new, joyous, supremely satisfying contact. Teach us to drink thee, that every blood cell, every thought, and every feeling may become saturated with thy joy and have their pleasure thirst quenched forever. After tasting thee, lead us to temptation if thou wilt. After we are sure of thy most tempting, everlasting gift of thyself, then test us with all thy temptations, if thou wilt. Teach us by comparison between felicity and sense distraction to completely remove of our own accord all material pleasures from our hearts. Bless us first with the light of godly habits, so that whenever the darkness of bad habits approaches, it will be spontaneously driven away. Teach us to forsake the misery-making, ignorant ways of living by letting us know and feel the comforting ways of wise living. Teach us to be so attached to thee that we cannot be at all attracted to material pleasures. Teach us by thy love to conquer all loves for worldly life. Millions do not love thee because they know not of thy alluring love. Millions love matter because they meet it first. Divine Beloved, why dost thou not come first in human life? O Father, how canst thou expect frail souls, ignorant of thee and burdened with bad habits, to know thy all-healing joy? Of all thy punishments, forgetfulness of thee is greatest. Punish us not, therefore, with forgetfulness. No matter what our tests may be, teach us to bear them joyously by feeling thy presence all the time in our hearts. For the knowledge of thy presence in the heart makes all our tragedies and comedies of life but dramas of extremely ecstatic entertainment. Our Bible lesson tonight is from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not love, it profiteth me nothing. Love suffereth long, and is kind. Love envieth not. Love vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Love never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail, whether there be tongues, they shall cease, whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know, even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. It is said that love is a many-splendored thing, and so it is, because all of life is love. If it were not for love, we would not live, because we are an expression of that divine love which came from the bosom of God. We are an expression of that bliss, that ecstasy, that constant grace and mercy, that sympathy, that understanding which pours from the heart of God. There is nothing truly in this world but God. Man abuses himself. God never abuses him. When man comes to the point where he relinquishes all desire for everything but God, then for the first time, he has peace in his heart. He feels kinship with all of his fellow beings. Now, there are many types of love in this world, as we know. Let us take the expression of the universe from the bosom of God. It is said by the rishis of India that the Vedas always were, are, and always will be. They compare them to God. And this is a peculiar thing, because you will ask now that we have the Vedas in writing, how can a book be something which had no beginning, which is, and will never have any ending? But you see, in the beginning, the Vedas were discovered by men who had a feeling in their heart, a reaching out and a reaching up for something that was extraordinarily beyond themselves. It was that shining something in their beings which gave them vision and inspiration. It was a feeling of the need for growth. And so gradually, through evolution, down through the ages, man developed to the point where he started asking questions. Where did this world come from? Who am I? How was I made? There was a story told recently in one of the papers about a Sunday school class. And the Sunday school teacher was preparing all of the students for a visit by the minister. And the subject was, who made me? And so she said that probably this would be one of the questions that the minister would ask the children in the class. Who made you? And one little boy spoke up and said, God made me. And the teacher said, that is excellent, Johnny. When the minister asks that question, you give that answer. So the great day came, and the minister visited the classroom. And after talking to the children a little while, he said, can anyone tell me who made you? There was a deep silence in the room. At last it became rather embarrassing. No one spoke. Finally, one little red-headed, freckle-faced girl spoke up. And she said, please, sir, The boy that God made is home with the measles. You see, we do not recognize in the beginning that God made us. We think of God as being always ever-present, ever-existent, of being omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, the all power, all light, all love. We think of this. And then we think of his creation, which is something separate and distinct in the sense that it was an act. And we think of creation as having a beginning and an end. And we think of God as having put forth this creation from his bosom, but yet now being separated from it. This is the idea of most of the people in the world today. They do not feel God within themselves. They look for God to come down out of heaven, if they think of him at all. But if we are to take every part of his creation as we see it before us, whether or not it is delusion, we, in our present state of consciousness, think it to be reality. If we look at this, we see that everything comes from a seed of its kind. Every single thing in the universe, even the mass objects, the stones, come from that integral part of God, which is something which we call material substance. And in that sense, it is a seed. But everything that came from God in the form of creation was always within God. As we have said before, there is no time but now, no place but here. Truly, we have never left the heart of God. It is all a thing of the mind, which makes us think that we are separate and distinct, something apart from God. And yet, how can this be? How can this be? We can never be apart from God because he is within us. He is on the altar of our heart and on the throne of our consciousness. We take him with us every place we go. We think many times, if I could go away from where I am, if I could have different conditions under which to live, then I would find peace. I would be able to meditate. I would find God. But these same people do not realize that they are following a path of karma yoga, or yoga in action, that God has placed them where they are because this is where they should be. And he has placed them there to learn one thing, and that is love of God and his fellow man. We are not put on this earth for the satisfaction of our own desires, but merely to find our oneness with that eternal spirit, which is everywhere equally present, and particularly within our own consciousness. So we have established that life comes from love. It is a union between spirit and nature. Nature is the female component of this dual essence, and spirit is that male essence. It is said that man and woman are opposite poles. That the man has his circumference nowhere, and he is constantly wanting to go off at a tangent. A woman has her circumference nowhere, but she has the center within her being. She is the magnetic force which constantly tries to keep the male force from straying, from going away, and finally to take it to God. It is said that man can never go to God except through the Father. And this is true. This is true. Man can never go to the Father except through the Mother. Ramakrishna, I believe, was the one who said that. And there have been many men, many saints, who have loved God in this mother aspect. Master Mahasya was one of the great examples. And when Master once visited him and sat at his feet, started to say something, he said, "Excuse me, little sir. I am making love to my Divine Mother. I am speaking to her. What a wonderful thing this is." The child is the expression, the final fulfillment of the love between man and woman. And that child, in the beginning, looks to the mother to take care of it. And it looks to the mother with a sort of a blind love. It is an inherent thing, because it is using blind will when it cries, when it is hungry. All of the things that it does is done with the idea of blind will. Then, as the child grows older, it starts to have love for things of the world. And it progresses along the path of the world, being taught all of the things which make it possible for that child to take its place in the universe. But that child is not taught about God being inside, of God being in the heart and reigning on the throne of the consciousness as a rule. The child is taught reading, writing, and arithmetic, but never the things of God. He is not taught that he is brought here but for the purpose of finding his oneness. He is not taught to concentrate, to meditate, to expand his consciousness in the things of the spirit, but rather in the things of the world. And this brings another type of love, because it brings love of all worldly things. It brings love of possession. It brings love of friends. It brings love of travel. It brings love of fame. It brings love of self and all of the little self's accomplishments. It is not until the child has grown and become a man or a woman that usually it starts to examine itself and ask these questions that we talked about in the beginning. Then it makes a choice. Perhaps it is the choice of a religion which has been in the family. It is the religion of the father and the mother. And so the child chooses that, or has it forced upon him or her, because this is the mother and father's idea of what the child should seek. But every single one should have the right to choose that religion which is a part and parcel of their very being. Because some will go to God through action, serving him, of dedicating all action to him when they become aware of what this means. Others will go to God through wisdom. Others will practice the mastery of the physical. And there will be others who will adapt, as Papa said, the greatest path of bhakti yoga, which will take them all the way to God and then back to serve as the Christ. It takes love to do this. And as the man and the woman grow, they seek for expressions of their love. They say, "I love my job. I love my new car. I love this food. I love many, many things." But they are talking of human love, because everything in the world is duality. It is an amazing thing when you start to think about it, that the heart has two sections. The lungs have two sections. The nose has two nostrils. The eyes are two, the ears are two, and in the mouth can be used both to speak and to take in food. The tongue can be used either to speak the word of God or to gossip and to destroy one's neighbors, and as a result to destroy oneself. Also, the perfect union is within the mouth. Because the tongue, when it is put back in the throat, is again the perfect union, or the mystic union, between matter and spirit right within this human body. So as man develops, he searches for this love, and he expresses it in many, many ways, and he looks around him, and he loves to be out in the open. He loves the ocean and the rivers and the lakes, and he loves to look up at the sky and see how blue it is and see the soft, fleecy white clouds floating through it. It uplifts his nature, his being. It makes him want to worship. And he looks at the sun and the moon and the stars and all of the growing things of earth. And he enjoys all of these things. He loves these things through his senses. There are some who love money. There are some who love crime. Love, it is said, is a many splendored thing. And yet, in some ways, it is debasing. It can only be thought of as being in splendor when it uplifts humanity. Finally, going through all of the various types of love, man seeks his counterpart, his mate, that one which is the other part of himself. And when he is fortunate enough to find such a one, he finds fulfillment. Because man and woman in marriage have a threefold purpose: to serve themselves, to serve their God, and to serve all of humanity. They must be very careful in their choice. They must be sure that the person is healthy in body, mind, and soul, that at least they have some interest in common. They must marry always for love, for nothing else, because if they were to do so, the whole marriage would be totally degrading. Marriage has a very wonderful, a very beneficial effect, not only from the standpoint of companionship, of fulfillment of the heart's need for human love, but also from the biological sense. It has a humanizing and an educational effect on all of humanity. It subdues and tames the nature of man and woman. You see, man many times, and woman also, operate in their animal natures. This is the physical nature. And many people, when they are married and sometimes when they are not, act like animals when they come together. And this is a terrible thing, because man and woman are not meant to do this, to come together in physical union. In marriage, which is a holy sacrament, is something very sacred and very special. It is not a thing of sex, which is ugly and degrading. Rather, it is an expression of the highest type of human love. It is a joining together with your beloved. And you can at that time either keep your mind in the gutter or put it on the things of the Spirit, feeling that you are merely sharing a wonderful love together. And when the need has been fulfilled, then the thing at all times to do is to lie in one another's arms and speak of God. And as man and wife do this, gradually the change within their beings take place. And there is less thought of that which is physical. The mind changes, the body changes, the very cells of both of these instruments changes. And the instruments change, and therefore, as a result, the soul or the spirit changes. And it becomes uplifted. Gradually, the need for physical union becomes less and less and less, until one is ready to seek the divine. And the day comes when the husband and wife one day awake and become aware that without giving it particular thought, but thinking only of God, they have reached the state of celibacy. Now, to the average man, and mostly to the average woman, celibacy is a thing not to be countenanced. They will ridicule anyone who makes such a statement. It happened when Master wrote his autobiography, and he made the statement in that autobiography that his mother and father had come together merely for the purpose of bringing children into the world, and they had had 8 children. There was an article written in the Time magazine as a review about the autobiography, and this idea was actually ridiculed by this magazine, that such a thing should be. Master many times talked throughout the book of being in tears because of his great love for God. They ridiculed him about that. It is a terrible thing to ridicule a master, because the penalty to be paid is the same as it says in the Bible to anyone who profanes the Holy Ghost, the holy vibration. The penalty to be paid is terrific. Man does not realize that he, along with the Christ, which is constantly held before him as the example, must be crucified on his own cross. He must pay for every single thing he does in word and action at some time, whether it be in this incarnation, this life, or in some other. He doesn't realize it. And he doesn't realize that what you do unto others returns to you a thousandfold, because actually it does. There was a man who went seeking in old China once for a master of learning. And he sought everywhere, and he could find no one. He was a man from the West, and he had read many of the wise things that had been written by the masters of China. And he kept searching and searching and searching, and still he found no one. Finally, he heard of a master who lived high in a hilltop. And he made a long journey to go to this one in order that he might sit at his feet and attain wisdom. He came to the bottom of the hill, and he found some men sitting there. They looked hungry, they were dirty. And he said to them, "Have you any knowledge of the master?" "Oh no," they knew nothing about him. He said, "I heard that there was a great wise man who lived at the top of the hill. His name is Lao Tzu. Can you not lead me to him?" And finally one said, "You must go there yourself." And some of the other priests offered him tea, hoping that he would give them of his bounty. So he started up the hill, and he climbed step by step. And finally, when he reached his destination, he saw this wise man standing there. And it was as though something happened to him within himself that had never happened before. As he gazed at this man who was tall and straight, with complete purity in his face and fire in his eyes, he saw a tremendous light in him and around him, and he fell at his feet. And he said, "Oh, Master, I have searched for you for so long, but I have not been able to find you. I have sought everywhere, many teachers, but at last I have found someone whom I see is really of God." And he said, "Get up, my son. It is a long time since I have taken a student, but I see that you are very, very sincere. I see that you want the pearl of great price." He said, "Did you ever hear the story of that pearl of great price?" And the young man said, "Not so, my lord." And he said, "Once the yellow emperor went around the mountain and crossed the Red Sea in search for his pearl of great price, which he had lost. He sought everywhere for it. He sought through his wit, but in vain. He searched with his vision, but in vain. He used his eloquence, but in vain. At last, he besought nothing, and nothing brought his pearl back to him." "Do you know, my son, what that means?" And he said, "Father, I think that the man went in search for his own soul, that he sought it everywhere, by every human means. And finally, when he stopped seeking, he realized that he was that." He said, "You have done well, my son, because this is the truth. This is the truth of all life, and so it is. There is no greater love than the love for God. And man and woman gradually attain this oneness together. And as they grow through life, striving ever to become closer to God, they not only overcome all of the human tendencies, the human passion, but they come to the point where one day their love for each other becomes a thing which seems to have wings. They not only love each other, but they are in love with each other. And it is a very special, uplifting love. It is a sanctifying love, because that human love finally has become divine. This is a tremendous experience, a tremendous experience. When the soul is ready, God sends another love, and that is the Guru. He who comes to take you out of the darkness into the light. It is truly said that God and Guru are one. And God's love is so great that He sends this one to us to uplift us. That one goes through all of the experience which God calls upon him to do in order to fulfill the particular destiny which is his in the world. The Guru goes through every trial, every tribulation. He is crucified on his own cross in one way or another. Sometimes it is not obvious to those who are with him. Sometimes it has happened before he ever comes to them. Sometimes it happens while he is with them. Christ showed the way. It was a tremendous way. It is said that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that they might be saved, that the whole world might be saved. This only begotten Son is the consciousness of the Christ. It is that consciousness which is universal, and it is also individual in each man. There is so much being questioned today about whether or not Jesus the Christ ever lived. And they tell the history of the apostles. They tell the history of the Bible. And yet constantly they are unearthing new things which seem to destroy the truth of what has been written before. And man is becoming more and more confused until he doesn't know what to believe. He doesn't know sometimes whether there is a God. He doesn't know whether Jesus the Christ ever truly lived, or if he was the figment of someone else's imagination. He doesn't know if the Bible was divinely inspired. And he thinks to himself, if it was, why does man think that he constantly has to change it? Why? Why? Questions, questions, questions. In this world of chaos today, the battle of Armageddon is going on, there can be no doubt. Because man is fighting man. Man is trying to overcome man. Man is trying to destroy himself in a way that he never has before. He has always tried to do this. There have been wars and wars and wars and rumors of wars between nations, but never like today, because man has within his hand the power for complete self-destruction. And so because he knows this, fear is born in his heart. He is reaching up for something higher, even those who have never acknowledged that there was a God. Fear has brought them to their knees, and now they are lifting their faces to God and saying, God, save me from whatever catastrophe is planned in this world. And his heart is turning there for comfort, for sympathy. And as he turns there, then the upliftment comes. Religion is needed today, as it never has been needed before. There are ministers needed. There are more masters needed for the upliftment of mankind. There was a story told once about just such a time as this. And it was told that a man had a dream. And in this dream, he saw himself on a plane. All of a sudden, he felt himself uplifted over the plane. And he saw himself looking downward. And as he gazed, he saw a lot of people running on the plane. And as they ran, they looked behind them in great fear. And he looked to see of that which they were afraid of. And he saw a great dark cloud coming rapidly toward them. Finally, it overtook them, overpowered them, and passed them by. When the cloud, the smoke, had vanished, he looked down, and he saw many lying on the ground. But there were a few left, and these few he saw sitting in a strange posture. They were sitting in the posture of the East, the lotus posture. They were those who had the power regardless of the terrible catastrophe which had occurred, to go up into the mountain of their own being, as it says in St. Matthew chapter 4, to escape, to cut off all the things of the senses, to escape from the bodily jars, so that they might not experience human death. Everyone who is afraid to go to God, who will not make the effort to go to God, must of necessity go through the experience of human death. But he who knows that breathlessness is deathlessness, who is able to control his breath, who realizes that he is that one which breathes, who does not identify himself with his body, with his mind, but knows that he is the eternal spirit within, the divine lover, the one who has created all of these things, and yet who strangely enough is that which is created. It is that one for whom death has no fear. He has the power to escape the three bodily jars and return to them at will. As St. Paul said, I die daily, and this is what the man of God can do. It is time that we wake up. It is time that we realize that time is running out. We have only to listen to the radio, to watch television, to read the newspapers and the various periodicals. We have only to see what all of the leaders of the world are doing today, and how the masses are rising up, trying to get freedom which has been denied them, trying to be released from slavery, to know that this is it. This is the battle of Armageddon. There is only one thing man must do, and that is to love God with all of his heart, with all of his mind, with all of his strength, and with all of his soul. This is one of the commandments that the Christ gave. And whether the Christ ever existed as a being is something we should not question, because he must have to have had such a tremendous impact on humanity as a whole. But sometimes to the seer, to the mystic one, to the one to whom prophecies are revealed, things are given to these ones in a different light. These masters go into the laboratories of their own souls, and they think on these things, and they meditate, and they go beyond the senses, and they go beyond the mind into that stillness of God, where that true consciousness exists, that which is the only reality. And they see that there is this possibility that what is described as the Christ being crucified on the cross, which has been depicted in picture form and by word of mouth as a wooden cross on the hill of Calgary, might in reality been an experience which Jesus of Nazareth went through in the human sense, because it speaks of the tree, and the human body is the tree also, as well as the cross. Man is the tree when he is turned upside down, and his hair, which are the roots of his being, in the earth, because in the human sense he is in reverse. He is not his God self, and all of his energies go into the earth, and in turn he is influenced by all the vibrations of the earth. As he sets one foot upon the earth, he touches the whole earth. As he contacts the human consciousness, all of the vibratory forces that are in this world, he contacts every thought of every human being there is. I was once shown a picture of this, how all of the planets are constantly going this way, and how this preservative force which God has put in to practice constantly keeps these planets from bumping into each other. He has made a perfect plan because of his perfect intelligence. Perfection came from God, and I saw that this perfection was within my own being also, and I saw my spine, and I saw the seven centers and the seven churches, And it was just like a rope wound around one strand around another. And I saw the spine going up the middle and the rope wound around it. And I saw these two forces going in opposite direction, constantly keeping everything in my body in a state of perfect preservation and order and life. This was a tremendous experience. And I saw that all the vibratory forces of my being were going out constantly, just as I was receiving these vibratory forces from the infinite, and that they were coming into my being, and that they were going first to my brain and down through these spinal centers, and that each center fed that particular part of the body over which it had jurisdiction, that there was constantly this duality that was in action all over the world. And I saw that God in his loving kindness had made this perfect creation, and that man in his utmost ignorance and stupidity was doing everything he could to destroy it. Everything. It is a terrible thing when we stop to think of what we do to ourselves, and yet we blame everybody, everything for it. So this guru comes, and when such a one comes to take us out of this state of ignorance, we know inside of ourselves. Oftentimes we go from teacher to teacher in the beginning, and we search here and there for something which will give us love, which will give us happiness, because that is man's eternal quest. He cannot live without love. And even when his love is unrequited, it acts as a wonderful thing, because you will remember the story of the disciple who handed the master an apple, and the master refused to accept it, and it returned to the disciple. It is just so. When you give the love of your heart with everything that you have, and it is not accepted, it returns to you to become purified, to become sanctified, to bring you a little bit closer to God, to fill your own being with a little more understanding, a little more purity, because of the suffering that you have endured. When you have the good fortune to come before a master, you have reaped something which is the result of your past karma. It is a privilege which is so great that it is second to none in this universe. When I think of my master's infinite patience with me, when I went to him about all of the things of the world, all of my personal troubles in the beginning, he looked into my heart and he saw that my heart was with God. But I didn't say to him, "Master, give me God," as many did. I didn't say that until the last time that I saw him. It was not the last time, it was a couple of times before that. And then when I asked him just this once, the tremendous experience which he gave me, I was uplifted. I was intoxicated with the bliss of God until I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it. Many are the experiences which come to the disciple when he finally meets the guru, because when you meet a true guru, it means that you have evolved to the point in your spiritual consciousness where you are ready to go the last mile toward God. And whether you make it in this incarnation or the next, the master takes you a tremendous way. He gives you many tests, many trials. But these are done not for your punishment, but because the love of God in him for you is so great. Because he has but one desire, and that is to take you to the realization of that love which can be found only within yourself. When a master comes on earth, the whole earth is sanctified. The whole earth is uplifted, and particularly those who come in contact with such a one. They who are privileged to cross his path are forever blessed, and they know that they kneel down finally in adoration. Sometimes it is while he is here, sometimes not until after he is gone. But the day comes when the realization of all that the Guru means, of all that he has done for each soul, comes to that one. And then the heart opens in tears, and it is purified. It is said that when a man cries for God, that his heart is truly with God, and so it is. And because then of his great love for God and the Guru, he puts his feet firmly upon the path. He dedicates his life to his Guru, because at this point he still cannot see God as spirit, as the power. He must have some evidence of God, so that is why God takes human form and comes down to teach all of his children and take them back to himself. At this point they cannot see him. And so because of the love and the devotion they have for this one, because perhaps they have realized a little of the cross the Master has borne, they say to God, God, here are my hands, here are my feet, my ears, my eyes, my speech. Here am I, God, take me, use me as you will. And at that moment, God hears the cry of the devotee. And he lifts him up, and he gives him vision to start him on his path. He has shown many, many things, and he walks in a new world. It is as though he is in this world, but not of it. He is in two worlds. He is uplifted, and he wants to reach out. He wants to drown himself in this ocean of bliss. He wants to see all of the things in this world that God is showing. The whole pageantry from the beginning of creation goes before his vision many times, and he reaches out for it. But God does not lift him up to the seventh heaven or to the 14th heaven. Not at this time. There must be a thorn of Satan in his side, something to keep him down, because he has many experiences to go through, and the opposing force is put there for a very wonderful purpose, and that is to keep him from going off before he has fulfilled his destiny. Finally, he comes to the point where he teaches, and then gradually, as his spirit unfolds, he wants to give himself so completely to God that he is willing to do anything which God directs. It is that time that God makes the extreme demand upon him. My son, are you willing to go the way of the cross and the crucifixion? And because he loves God so much at that time, he says, yes, he is willing to do this. There is no fear. You see, when a devotee starts in meditation, and particularly when he starts to do Kriya, he has many, many experiences, and these experiences, because they are new, frighten him. He feels pains in his head. He feels a queer sensation of whirling, a dizziness. Perhaps his breath slows down and stops, and he feels himself about to be taken out of his body. These are peculiarly new experiences, and because they are of the unknown, he has fear of them. But isn't this true of everything we meet in life? What we know today, we didn't know when we were younger. The things that we accept in the world as a part of our everyday living, such as refrigerators, stoves, garbage disposals, automatic dishwashers, airplanes, atomic submarines. We can think of a thousand things that were not even heard of when I was a child. And yet today, these belong to my life as just a commonplace thing. And so it is as you progress in the spirit. If you have the courage, the faith, to take each step, knowing that your Father God will never give you more than you are able to bear. If you realize that you are constantly being rocked in the cradle of His presence, that He, being your infinite Father, holds you in His arms of everlasting bliss, you are not afraid then to swim in the ocean of bliss with sure, strong strokes, because you know that because He has you in His arms, that you are safe, and that He will return you to the shores of the world. All of these things happen to each devotee on the path. Some see visions, others have other experiences, and they become frightened. But you see, when your consciousness starts to expand in the spirit, the brain expands to hold this increased consciousness. It must give some place, so it stretches out, and the head aches. And in the beginning, particularly if you start to talk to people, to give sermons, and let the Spirit of God flow through you, as no minister should give a sermon without letting that happen, then afterwards you have a tremendous pain in your head. And it is very difficult to come down out of that state, and sometimes the pain remains for such a long time that because you are a novice on the path, maybe you don't have your master with you, you take a couple of aspirin to get rid of it. But gradually, over the period of months, of years, and this power continues to flow through, your brain continues to expand to accommodate it, this pain leaves you, and you can talk for hours at a time without any pain whatsoever, without any consciousness of food, the need for food or drink, because God is the food. He is all we need. And if we live in His infinite spirit, we are not dependent upon these things that are given to us to feed our bodily flesh. We are not dependent upon them at all. And so these experiences do come, and they should not be feared, because it is just a change that is going on within your being. All the cells of your body, of your mind, are being changed. The structure is being changed. They are being purified. They are being reformed. They are being re-energized and revitalized with the Spirit. And gradually the whole change takes place. And this is the alchemy. This is the philosopher's stone, which had its consciousness completely in the human world, on all things of the world and in the human sense, but now has been turned to the gold of God. This is what it means to have a new body in Christ. But this cannot come without the crucifixion. And strangely enough, as the seer has gone through this experience, he knows that he has been crucified on his own cross. And because the experience has been such a terrific one, he doesn't understand everything that has happened to him. But one thing stands out very clearly in his vision, that when this crucifixion takes place, the vision of Christ on the cross is given to him. He sees the terrible torture that this man of God has gone through. He sees that it is far worse than has ever been described by human lips or written about in the Bible or in any book. And he is told that he must never forget the outer Christ and God the Father in the universal sense, while he follows the way of the cross and the Christ within him. And so he wonders, is this which is spoken of, which is written of in the Bible, was this really an experience where the man Jesus was actually nailed on a wooden cross for all to see? Or was this an experience which the disciples whom he had chosen were privileged to witness? Even, for instance, as in my own case in India, where Papa gathered all the people around there, all of them in the ashram, until the room was filled. And he said, I want you here so that you may see what it means to destroy a human ego. Is this what it means? And then all of the children of the senses know that something has happened with inside. Because up until that time, you have been uplifted in the spirit. You've been given visions. You have felt the bliss of God. You were able to pen wonderful poems, articles about God. God had poured forth from you, and now you were as one dead, and this happens inside of you. And you don't understand it. And people sense something different about you, and all want to leave you. All want to leave you. And this is the hardest of all, because when you need understanding, not knowing what has happened to you, you don't have any. We remember what the Christ said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And so it is, so it is. I was thinking the other day of this beautiful song which has been written. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? And I thought of Jesus the Savior within myself. And all that that wonderful Spirit who was within me, was God within me, had to go through in order to save this human self from sin for all time, so that the end of the world would come. And I thought of him as I saw him on the cross. And I wondered whether that was Jesus the Christ about whom I read in the Bible, about whom all men speak. Or I wondered if it was my own Christ, that Christ which was within every man. And my love for him was so great that I would have done anything for him. This is divine love. And it was wonderful to feel that way, because for the first time, I felt that love again. For the first time, I could cry for him and for all of his children. I had cried before, but I saw at that time that I had been crying for myself and not for him. And then I wanted to die. I wanted to die all the way. My human self, this little self, even though it's in the causal state now, that still hasn't given up all the things of the flesh. And the love that poured over me was beyond all human expression. It cannot be expressed in words, because it is a thing of the Spirit. And I realized that no matter what the cost, I had to go through the final crucifixion, the crucifixion of the mind. And I thought of all the things that I had said against other people, of all the things that I had done. I thought of the jealousy and the hate and the envy and the lust and the sense of possession and all of the things that are still harbored in my mind. And I thought how terrible that crucifixion was going to be. And it says in the Bible that you should not profane the Holy Ghost. And it seems that even that little thing was not denied me, that I was made to go through every sin that man and woman have known, every one, and pay the full price. This is my destiny on earth. And this has happened to me. But you see, because it was my destiny, I don't mind. My love for God is so great that I willingly give my life for him, either to take, to no longer be in this world, or to take that I might realize completely my oneness with the Father, and having realized that oneness, come back to serve in the consciousness of the Christ. Love is a many splendored thing, but the splendor of God is so great that nothing in this whole wide world can compare with it. Do not look for phenomena. Look for the light. Feel the bliss of God. Be one with him. Give up all of the things that are keeping you from this wonder and this beauty. Learn to love God within you. Learn to become one with him, until there is nothing but that divine love emanating from your being. Free yourselves stop punishing yourselves. When this happens to you, the beauty of God pours forth from you, as it has from Barbara. This wonderful, wonderful chants that come from her heart. Each experience which she has, she puts into the form of worship and chanting to God. And you can't but listen to these things and know that she is one with God as she does these things, because there is nothing but God there. They are filled with worship, with beauty. And this is part of her soul, a very wonderful part, which is going out. This is a vibratory force which will go all over the world and come back to her in God realization and divine love. And so, as we go forth on our daily life, let us remember to do unto others as we would be done by. Because remember that each one of us, this is the law of man, each one of us has a cross. Each one of us has to be crucified before we can gain immortality. Constantly say to God, O my beloved, my infinite beloved. And the time will come when even that will not be necessary, because you will have become that one beloved, shedding your light, your sun, your divine love, your grace over all the earth.